meet and discuss mutual problems, what things they've found out.
Interview with Art Hallgren, H-A-L-G-R-E-N, COPE, C-O-P-E, Director, AFL-CIO, Tallahassee, Florida, May
20th, 1974. In the state of
Florida. So you're the only state that has the one-week labor school?
We're the only state that has it as a mandate in the Constitution. Other states hold them, but we are mandated by our Constitution.
Is this primarily a political school?
No. It has politics involved, but it covers collective bargaining, new legislation, whatever is of interest to the participants. We try to get a feel of what they would like to have in the school and try to grind in whatever is of interest to them.
I want to make sure I've got the spelling of your name correct.
H-A-L-L-G-R-E-N.
And you've been in Florida for how long?
We moved from New York in 1948. Moved down in 1948. And I started with Pan American World Airways in Miami. It's a mechanic, aircraft engine mechanic.
That's the period of our book from 1948 through 1974. Oh. So when you moved down here, what are the changes you've seen in politics that have occurred in that 25 years?
Oh, there have been great changes. Dade was always the most liberal area, but we find now other areas of liberal persuasion springing up. We have more of a liberal aspect in Hillsborough and Polk County. Of course, Jacksonville, all the urban areas are much more liberal than they were. The legislature has changed greatly because of the growth in the state. We have a much more, still not a liberal legislature by any means, but it's much more liberal than it was. And it was in the hands of the so-called pork choppers when we came up here first.
You've been here how long? In Tallahassee?
Oh, I only come up here for the legislative session.
But how, perhaps? How long have you been COPE director, I suppose?
Well, I've been COPE director since 1961.
So you've been coming up every year since then, at least every legislative
session
since then?
Oh, maybe a few I missed when I was busy doing other things, but in the main, everyone since 61. But we have less of the drive now on the part of the enemies of organized labor, the enemies of labor, if you will, or the opponents of labor. Than we did before. They're beginning to understand. We've made, I think, breakthroughs in some of the rural areas in getting these people to understand that the labor people are not a bunch of goons that are going to come in and spoil everything. We do have the interests of the community at heart as well as the interests of the working people. But I think we've seen some strides forward in that area.
Was reapportionment the primary
yes.
thing?
Yes. Yeah, reapportionment was a great factor in that. We got the greater representation from the areas where we had the greater population. Of course, that doesn't hold true all in every area, though. For example, Broward County is a very conservative area. A lot of retired coupon clippers live down there, and they're very conservative in their voting. Dade County, we have a lot of retired people, but they're the people who retired out of the labor movement, mainly from New York, New Jersey, and northeastern states. We find on the West Coast with the retirees, we have a combination of both. We have some wealthy ones and some come from a labor background, so we have a mix as far as retired folks are concerned. But now with the advent of public employees, collective bargaining, we're finding a much greater interest and acceptance of organized labor as such in the state.
Has organized labor as a percent of the workforce grown?
It has grown some, but not to the extent that we would like to see it grow. And I
what is it now?
I would say now we have probably 40% of the workforce is organized. The potential, yeah, probably 40%.
Is that the highest of the 11 southern states?
I don't know. Honestly, I couldn't tell you if it would be or not. I don't imagine.
Does that remain pretty steady, or is it
yes.
increasing?
It remains pretty constant. One, we haven't had the unionization of many of the industries that come into Florida, especially South Florida, where we had this huge influx of Cuban workers. They were not unionized as they come in. The unions tended to ignore them, thinking they were going to be a passing group and were not to be reckoned with. Now, unions, particularly some of the trades, the carpenters, for example, have two or three locals that are almost entirely Latin American in makeup, but they've gone in and organized these folks. And the Cubans, when they first come over, were taking any kind of jobs at any kind of money, but they soon realized they were being taken advantage of and decided they better find someone to represent them. And the trades suffered greatly in the Miami area, in that they didn't organize the construction workers. These Cubans come in, and some of them had capital, and they started small construction companies, and they were just ignored by the unions involved, figuring, well, they're never going to build anything big. But as they finished a motel or a hotel, not a hotel, but a small shopping center, then they had some more capital, and they started to build larger complexes, and now, I'd say probably 60% of the small contractors in the greater Miami area are Cuban and are non-union. And this has had a big impact and provides a real problem for the union contractor in the area, because these people are able to come in with a lower wage scale and undercut some of the bids. It's creating a problem.
How many members are there in the AFL-CIO?
We have affiliated with us about 180,000 right now. We have a potential of, according to the national figures, we got this just as a result of their going to this computerized system of registration, identification. We have a potential of nearly 300,000. So we've got about a third of somewhere near, maybe a little better than a third of people who should have a board.
Is there a labor newspaper as such?
No, we don't have a labor newspaper. We do, we just put a woman on staff as our women's activities director. We put her on last year, and she and I put out a, what we call a COPE monthly report. That's the nearest thing we have to a newspaper as such right now. I put out once a month. It relates to the election issues, the candidates, anything that we feel is important on the more or less the political front. We do cover some general news, what's happening here and there. We're gradually, as best we can, working it into a more of a news sheet, something along the line that Barney Weeks has in Alabama. We don't have a newspaper. We've talked about having a newspaper. We've never.
Could we just get some copies of that 14?
I have one just come in today. It's the latest one.
What's the distribution on the newsletter?
Unfortunately, we're not mailing this except to our... We run a mailing list on all the local unions that are affiliated, plus all the delegates to the last convention. And that amounts to about, I'd say, a mailing of around 2,000. We would like to expand that, but we have some resistance. One, because our mailing list is not as accurate as it should be, and we're hoping to use the National AFL-CIO computer bank to print out labels for us once we get the computer information updated. We hope to be able to use that and order labels from the AFL-CIO and make a mailing to the total membership. We think this is important to do. You can keep that, and I can get more to you if you want. That would, Bill Allen just brought that from our Tampa office. As I say, it's probably being mailed today.
What kind of role does both your office and labor play in state politics in Florida? Do they endorse candidates?
Yes. We're having a real internal rumble right now in my endeavor to hold a conference to endorse candidates in the first primary. I feel it's important that we do this. This is the time you get your chance to pick somebody. You might not pick a winner, but we have a real problem because of the race for the United States Senate. We have several very friendly candidates in there. We have Dick Stone, who has always been a labor endorsed candidate, he's currently the Secretary of State. He has announced and is running for the U.S. Senate seat that Ed Gurney now holds. We have Richard Pettigrew, a state senator who's always been a good friend of labor, has announced and is running for the U.S. Senate seat. We have Bill Gunter, who is congressman from the 5th District. He is announced and running for the same seat. And that's the major ones. And we have Mallory Horn, who is the current president of the Senate, who's presiding today in the state Senate. He has announced and is running. He'll be a very conservative candidate. I wouldn't believe that we would find ourselves in a posture of endorsing him, but that's within this room, because if I heard us say that right now, we'd be in trouble. He has the power of life and death over any legislation. That's why we're keeping rather quiet until after the session ends in 2 weeks. The session ends the end of May.
Do other committees endorse in the first primary?
Some do and some don't. We did in the last general election. It was the first time Florida did endorse in the primary, so we had some misgivings about it, but on the whole, it proved to be the best move we ever made, and it really put us in the limelight. We intend, we intend to have a COPE conference. We have a very late filing date. They don't have to file for office until July 23rd, which puts it, you know, pretty far away, and we're trying to guess why. If you notice in that sheet, we're saying hold the line. We find our affiliates, you know, starting to support one candidate or another candidate, and this is giving us a problem. So we're trying to get them not to commit themselves to any candidate until we can hold such a conference. I doubt sincerely we would require a 2/3 majority of delegates in attendance for an endorsement. We would require the 2/3 vote. I don't envision, unless something very dramatic happens, any one of the candidates being able to capture 2/3 of the vote. So I would assume that at least in the Senate race, we would probably end up with a no endorsement in that particular race. But I think in the governor's race, no question, we would endorse Reuben Askew, the incumbent, for re-election.
Who did they endorse Askew last time?
We didn't in the primary, no. There again, we had several friends, and he was not our choice in the primary. We endorsed Chuck Hall, who was then the Metro mayor and seemed to be the most likely candidate. He was well known, had a lot of money, and seemed to be a man who was going to go. And at that time, you probably heard the Reuben who. Nobody knew. We knew Reuben Askew because he'd been a good friend of ours in the Senate. He came from Escambia County, Pensacola, and was just not well known. The same was true with Walton Lawton Child. Nobody knew Lawton. And we told them, both of them friends, you don't have a chance, you know. Reuben who? Nobody knew him. Walton Lawton, who knew Lawton Child? But as Lawton started to make his walk, I realized he was gathering $1 million worth of publicity every day without spending a dime, because the papers and media were covering every town that he would go through, and he was headlines in every paper as he went around the state. And he captured the imagination of the people and really went in. He's been a good senator. And the same with Reuben. Once the primary was over, then we did endorse Reuben Askew in the runoff. But we didn't endorse him in the first, only because we just didn't think he had a chance. We liked him, he was friendly and a good candidate, but we just didn't think he could survive the runoff, survive the election to get in the runoff. But he surprised everybody. And he's been a very good governor, as far as we're concerned, but probably the one that we've been closest to of any of the governors that I can remember. Certainly we'd like to see Gurney out. If he isn't out by his own doings, we'd certainly like to see him lose out in the election if he runs. Personally, I'd like to see him stay in office and have him as the opponent. I think he'd be the easiest to beat. I'm very much concerned. There's a very, very sharp gal who's now serving with the Public Service Commission, Paula Hawkins, Republican. She's a member of the Republican National Committee. very, very attractive woman, very articulate, and she did win a statewide race and running for this public service seat. And she used this seat to project herself in the public eye. And she goes on as a sweet little housewife, you know. She has no more seen a broom. I always say the only broom she's ever seen is the one she rides when she's going back to her house at night. She's a witch. She's going to be a devil to beat, though, because when they had this trucker strike, she made sure she had news coverage, and she got up on the back of the flatbed trailers and telling the drivers how much she was concerned with their plight and how much she was going to do as a public service commissioner to help them out. She came on like gangbusters. So whoever wins, if she is a candidate and is in the general election, whoever the Democrat is going to have a tough job to beat her. I wouldn't take odds on that one at all. I'm very much concerned about her. So I hope Gurney stays in, because she has said, now she may change her mind, July is a long way off. She has said if Gurney seeks re-election, she will not oppose him. But I don't know, I read the cards just a little differently than that. She may change her mind when she sees him having some problems, especially the financial problems he's having right now and the legal problems he's having.
Does the what percentage of organized labor in the state is affiliated with AFL-CIO?
Well, I'd say, again, less than a third of what our potential is. We're picking up, though. And a great deal of the problem is the fact that the international unions have not followed up in many areas where it's been a difficult area to service. They just haven't given the groups who want to organize. It's not for the lack of people wanting to be organized, it's a lack of organizational effort on the part of the various international unions. Now, when Disney came in, they built Disney World 100% union, but Disney said he wanted unions on the property, but he would not deal with a half a dozen different unions. He didn't want any jurisdictional disputes. So they formed, first time to my knowledge, a council of the building trades, and they agreed to a general contract for all the trades, of course, with varying scales for the different skills, and, you know, separate clauses for the different crafts and trades, but they negotiated a master contract for all the trades. Once the place was built, they did the same thing with the service trades. They had various unions, hotel and restaurant workers, service trade, service employees, oh, you name it. They had them all coming in wanting to represent the service employees, and Disney again said the same thing, I'll sign a master contract and you'll all work under one contract with various provisions for each different group as it relates. And they have a council now of service employees. That's worked out well for management. Any fights that come up, the unions have to go outside. I talked to a member of middle management of Disney a while back, a good friend of mine, I know from the chemical field. And he said, it's really funny, Art, when you have a dispute come up, you just say to the unions, okay, you settle the dispute and come and tell us what you want to do. So it really takes the burden off management's back in this instance. But as I started to say, there's no lack of interest in unionization, but there's a lack of organizers in the state to do the job. But there's a growing interest now. Almost everybody's getting interested in it, since we have this provision in the Constitution that was put in when they revised the state constitution, that public employees, they wrote into the same clause that we have our so-called right to work law, and they added to the right to work language, and public employees shall have the right to bargain collectively. And since then, they've been trying to draft guidelines. Well, this session, they probably will succeed in drafting guidelines after about 5 years of battling over it, but the various internationals have come in and forced now to organize the public employees. The AFT has stepped up its efforts. The firemen and oilers are in here organizing service employees. The carpenters are interested in service employees. They're all forming arms of their various organizations and sending organizers in and organizing the hospital workers and service employees in the various state and county municipal entities.
Did I misunderstand? I thought you said 40% of the workforce was organized. Did you say now a third?
Did I misunderstand you?
No, I think we were talking about the total workforce. That's what you were talking about.
Right. The total workforce, what part is organized? What percentage is organized?
I'd say about a third.
About a third, yeah.
40 was high.
Yeah.
A third is probably more realistic.
Does Cope get involved in statewide races and the state legislature?
Yes.
That's about it?
So we get involved in the national.
Congress, but anything below that?
Yes. At the local level, our central bodies take action in county commission, city commission races, mayor's races.
In the statewide races, what kind of assistance do you get?
When a central body makes its determination that they're going to back certain councilmen or certain people from their area, if they request us, we will make a mailing for them listing the candidates that Cope endorsed. All they have to do is send us a letter and we will give them the mailing at no charge to them as affiliated organizations. If it's a real important race to them, we'll go in and help organize their volunteer women, setting up phone banks and doing things like that to help the candidates that are endorsed. We don't give as much financial help as we would like to because we just don't have the funds. We're alleged to be very rich by our opposition, but we don't have the money. But I always contend we do have votes if we put them to work.
But do you contribute in the state legislative races?
There again, it's more of in-kind contribution rather than actual cash contributions. Now, we have passed last year an election reform law, which is a very stringent one, severely restricts and limits the activities in which we can take part without reporting. We can do any in-house work, with our own membership without any problem, but as soon as we start doing anything directly for the candidate that involves monetary expenditure, we have to report as a committee of continuous existence. We have to report to the Secretary of State, to the Director of Elections, and to the County Court Clerk exactly how much was spent. And we have to have prior permission from the candidate before we make any expenditures. And that would even be include printing up bumper stickers or anything like that for him. We have to have his approval. He has to report it, and we have to report it.
How do you feel about that law?
I think it's going to be rather restrictive. It's got its good points and bad points. The intention of it was to get to these committees that would form, a month before election and go to a candidate and say, Mr. Jones, we'll endorse you, but we have to have $500 for a newspaper ad in order for the citizens, for better government of Leon County to support you. In other words, they were taking money from the candidates, and actually it was a racket. The legislation was particularly aimed at that. However, once they wrote down language that would cover that, we found that it was all encompassing. It included any committee that did any kind of activity for any candidate. We recommended some specific changes, and we're hoping now that the changes will pass, which will make the reporting procedure easier. Not that we're not afraid to report, our books are open anyway for anyone to inspect, but the reporting procedure was quite complex. We're concerned what it will mean to a local union, for example, if they get involved in a campaign and fail to report. They can find themselves in trouble, but they can also get the candidate in trouble if they spend money without notifying him ahead of time, because he's held to be responsible for any action taken by someone for him, which we think is rather unfair. For example, if you were running for office, if really I wanted to sabotage you, I didn't like you, I could simply run out and take a full-page ad, I could report it, and you'd fail to report it, and you'd be in trouble. Or I could report it to you after the fact, maybe it's already going to press, and you'd say, no, I don't want it. We find some candidates still around the state who are a little bit reluctant to advertise the fact that they're being supported by organized labor, but this is less of That's one change I've found since we started in 1961. We had a lot of candidates who would say, come in the back door and say, we want your support, but don't publicize it. We find now, in fact, we've pretty much adopted a stipulation, if you don't want to be publicly known that we're supporting you, forget about it. You know, if we're not worth mentioning in your reports, then we don't want to support you. If you're ashamed of us, forget it.
Is that campaign expenditure law the toughest in the country as far as you're concerned?
I think it's one of the toughest. I just talked to Washington about a half hour ago, and they're very concerned.
Is it the toughest in the South?
Yes, I would think so.
But you don't know about the rest of the country?
I would say it's one of the toughest, if it isn't the toughest. It really is a very strict law, and I've been growing gray hairs over it, not so much for our part as a state organization, but again, if you notice in that newsletter, and I told our gal to stress it, not to make any contributions without first contacting me, because they're going to put themselves out of jam. And it provides some pretty severe penalties, fines and so forth. And it does put the candidate in jeopardy, too.
Does it have any teeth?
Yes.
It does?
Mm-hmm. In addition to that, it sets up a panel which is composed of members of both parties and then a chairman appointed by the governor, and they are charged with the responsibility of investigating any alleged violations of the law. And I can just see how a group like this could really go on a witch hunt, even though you have representation from both parties and supposedly an impartial chairman. He could still get into an awful jam if somebody wanted to really harass you with it.
You said one of the major changes is that people now want the open union endorsement. Mm-hmm. Is there anybody left that doesn't want it? Who would see it as a kiss of death?
There are still some in some areas of the state, and I think it's probably true that they would rather.
How about statewide?
Statewide, no. Statewide, they're willing to. The governor, for example, was very proud and pleased to have our support, as were most of the
cabinet.
All of the cabinet. And we supported them all openly. And they brag about the support they had from organized labor. In fact, I sometimes worry about our governor. He, you know, is constantly on the attack as far as big business is concerned. One of his first and foremost programs was to pass a corporate profits tax, which was very unpopular, you could well imagine, but he pushed it through, and we helped him push the referendum through. We worked hard on it. By the way, that's another thing this election law addresses itself to, is not only candidates, but any issues. If we, for example, if we were in the big right-to-work fight now, trying to get rid of the right-to-work law, we would have to report any monies, as would our opposition have to report any monies expended on an issue. Doesn't apply to voter registration or get out the vote, but it does apply to an issue. The strange thing, really funny, I suppose, in a way, the first group that really got themselves caught in the trap when the law was passed was the Leon County Chamber of Commerce. They were out plugging for a road bond issue, and they should have known, of all people, right here in the capital county, they found themselves in violation of the law. They hadn't reported to the Secretary of State, and they hadn't reported to the Circuit Court their expenditures on behalf of this issue. They more or less dropped it because the law was so new, but they got their wrists slapped publicly and not really legally, but there are many groups that are really on thin ice right now. They don't realize the law is, for all intents and purposes, on the books and in practice and in fact law. And anybody who goes out and does any endorsing or working on an issue right now could find themselves in trouble if somebody went to this board and reported a violation. So something that we're very concerned about. Again, not so much the state. We feel we're pretty much aware of what we can and can't do. In fact, I'm planning, as soon as the session's over, going around to meet with the various central labor groups to explain in depth and maybe get the author of the bill, Elvin Martinez, Representative Martinez, to travel along with me to have him or someone from the Secretary of State's office go along with me to explain the reporting procedures so they don't get themselves in trouble.
Are you mounting a campaign to repeal right to work?
No, not this time.
You intend to?
No, not right now. See, ours is a part of the Constitution. In order to get it off the pad of the Constitution, we would have to have a resolution passed by two-thirds of the legislature, then a referendum vote of the people. And I would be very, very reluctant to put it out as a test right now without trying to repeal it, because the very nature of the name, right to work, it sounds so, you know, much like motherhood. People just don't understand that it doesn't give anyone the right to work. It doesn't do anything of the kind. And I think we would certainly lose the battle without a very, very vigorous educational program. We would have to spend a lot of money to really get it across. Because we've found even in local unions where they've run some polls, secret ballot polls, do you think the right to work law is a good law or not? We've had some unions, and when members go to the meetings, they're usually pretty good union members, fairly well informed. And we've had one local union, as many as 60% of the people voting in the meeting say the right to work is a good law. They just don't understand it. Don't understand its implications and what problems it can cause.
Do you or the president or any of the officers of the AFL-CIO serve on state boards and commissions?
I'm on a commission, the Migrant Labor Commission, have been for about 5 years now. It's a joint legislative commission. President Harris served on the charter, this is a picture of the Charter Revision Commission. He was served on that. Our Secretary Treasurer serves on the Apprenticeship Council, which is a jointly administrated group, management, labor, and government. And I serve on the governor's Labor Advisory Committee, which is a standing committee. There's 10 of us on that. The president and myself both serve on that. He meets with us, either he or his staff or agencies meet with us quarterly to bring us up to date on what's going on, get suggestions from us, input, particularly before the legislature, on what changes we wanted to see in workman's comp, unemployment comp, things of that nature. So we're active in that area. And of course, we're interested in fact, there was an election committee meeting this morning where there were amending some of the election laws. We're trying to keep track of what they're trying to do to the election law. And again, I have hopes that we do make successful making these changes that I talked about earlier.
What percent of the organized workforce is black or Cuban?
I'd say probably 15%.
15% of the FBL is both black
or Cuban.
How would that break out black Cuban?
Probably 10% black and 5% Cuban. Only not that Cuban workers aren't in areas that could be organized or should be organized. They're just not union. I mean, they are in the force. But for example, the garment industry in Miami used to be entirely union. And a lot of Spanish-speaking people, but not the Cubans. But when the Cubans come in, they even set up their own shops and took over, I'd say, at least 80% of the garment work in the Miami area.
Are they predominantly black unions and Cuban unions, or are they integrated?
Most of the... Well, it varies now. I would say most of the Cuban unions are predominantly Cuban, like I mentioned, the Carvedwood, 90% in the Dade County area. The blacks are integrated, and particularly in your industrial type unions, you have a pretty good mix, communication workers, the airline people, but you have a pretty fair mix there. Not as high a percentage as what probably should be or what the blacks would like to see, but there is a mix there. a lot of your crafts are still lagging behind. The exception, I think, would be the brick masons. They have quite a few blacks. The laborers is almost predominantly black. Your longshoremen are predominantly blacks. Some Spanish in both those instances, but mainly the black, particularly laborers and longshoremen. Very few whites. Particular groups. Your service trades, hotel and restaurant workers, I'd say 90% Cuban now. It used to be black. They displaced the blacks in that particular field. Taxi drivers, almost exclusively Cuban in the Miami area. Clerks in stores, where there used to be blacks and whites. Almost all Cuban, again in the Miami area.
Is the major influence of organized labor in local elections in Dade County, Duval, and the Tampa area?
No, I would say, as I said earlier, that our real impact, I feel, is in a lot of the rural areas. I think that we can flex a much stronger muscle in rural elections than we can in the urban areas, because we do have a tighter knit group. We can zero in on a candidate or a group of candidates and win with them if we have a united labor operation. I can give you a classic example. When Governor Reuben Askew was running for re-election as a state senator in Escambia County, he called me one night, just well, the night before election. He said, "Art, I'm in trouble over here. If the labor folks don't get out tomorrow and vote for me, I'm not going to win. I won't come back to Tallahassee as a senator." And I said, "Well, we'll see what we can do." So the next morning, I got on the phone and called all the business agents that I knew in Escambia County and told them to be sure and get their people out. It was going to be a close race, and we wanted to see Reuben Askew return to the Senate. Well, we were successful, and he has never forgotten that, even since he's been governor. He said, "I probably wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the work you did for me when I was back running for that Senate seat." So I think in instances like that, prove out to me at least the fact that we can be very effective in the rural areas. You take a town like Palatka, where they have a paper mill. I'd say probably 80% of the people in Palatka are union or have union, connections.
How about in the legislature? What are the major issues you see coming up that labor has a specific interest in?
Well, of course, the one thing that we're always interested in is the improvement of workmen's compensation and, of course, unemployment compensation. We're trying now, and we're within reach of a formula concept on workman's comp instead of a dollar amount. We're trying to tie it to 66 2/3% of the average weekly wage in the state, so that when the wages go up, the compensation will automatically rise with the wages. We want to go back every legislative session and hat in hand and beg for another $10 to keep up with the cost of living. One of the other things that we're vitally concerned with in this particular session is the restoration of our tax exemption status that we enjoyed for a number of years, which we lost two sessions ago. Union property was tax exempt, at least that part of the union property that was only used for meetings and for office space. Anything they rented out, naturally we expected to pay taxes on. That exemption was removed two sessions ago in a last-minute bill that we just didn't have our eye on, and it went through and removed our exemption. But at the same time, removed the exemption for all the Elks Clubs, the Masonic Orders, and everybody else. So it caused a big furor with all organizations. All fraternal organizations lost their tax exemption status on their property, their real property. And since then, all of us have been working toward getting that restoration of this tax exemption. However, this session, the bill went through real early, and it only covered fraternal orders. It didn't cover anybody else, and giving them back their tax exemption status. And that was signed into law almost up before anybody realized that it happened. But now we're just trying now in the last days of the session to get unions back on that particular role of the tax exempt status for union property as a non-profit operation. Whether we'll be successful or not, I don't know. That's why we were kind of busy this morning. If we don't get out of committee today, our chances of getting it are almost impossible.
How about agency shop legislation?
Agency shop has been ruled unconstitutional. There was a test case between Food Fair and one of their employees. They had an agency shop agreement, and it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court held that under the law, the state law, or the Constitution as written, that the agency shop was not legal in the state of Florida. Now, some states do have right-to-work laws, can have agency shops, but it was outlawed in Florida by the Supreme Court decision. This is something we've argued, and we have some receptive ears as far as the legislature is concerned on that portion. They feel that it's only right. If a person is getting the protection of a union, they should pay their fair share. Not be obliged to join or pledge allegiance to, but certainly pay their freight as far as paying for the organization. And there are a surprisingly growing number of legislators who would be willing to listen to that kind of argument. So I think we may find that to be the route rather than an all-out fight to get rid of so-called right to work law. An easier route anyway. And that would certainly accomplish as much for us as we need.
In dealing with the legislature, do you concentrate your efforts more or less primarily and almost exclusively on those type of issues that you feel directly related to union members, such as the ones you've described?
No. We were very much interested in the extension of homestead exemption. We have a homestead exemption in Florida for first $5,000. We upped that this year. They upped it to $10,000 for people over 65. We were very much in favor of that. We're always looking for tax reform. We supported the governor's proposal on corporate profits tax. You know, we feel a better spread of the tax burden is important for all the people, not just the working people. And when we talk about workmen's comp and unemployment comp, we're talking about every worker, not just the union worker. So I don't think any of the issues, except for possibly the right to work, and even the right to work, is not a labor union problem. It's a problem for a worker who wants to get an organization in and finds it difficult, not impossible. But
I didn't really mean issues limited to organized labor, but I mean primarily economic issues such as taxes,
yes.
Workmen's comp. Is there a state minimum wage law in Florida?
No, we tried to get a state minimum wage for several sessions. We proposed a dollar minimum wage, and we had one legislator say, I don't have a man working for me that's worth more than 40 cents an hour. I move we table the bill, and that was the end of our minimum wage. So we really haven't seriously tried to get a minimum wage. We feel the federal law is, you know, pretty much taken care of. The majority of workers. We are interested in the plight of the migrant worker. We have quite a few migrants. That's why I have a great interest in this migrant labor commission that I serve on, investigating not only the wages but the conditions and so forth these people have to work under. We feel this is a very important area of endeavor for the state. In fact, we had a program going a while back and it fell through. I was very disappointed. We had worked with the Laborers International Union. They sent staff down here, even one of their vice presidents. And our thought was to organize the migrant workers into the laborers' union. And then when there were lulls in the harvesting and picking operations, they could be used as common laborers on a building construction site. This would tend to upgrade them and move them out of the migrant stream and make them a more permanent workforce. And it looked like it was going to go, and suddenly the Laborers International lost interest or ran out of organizing money or something, and the whole thing just blew up, and that was the end of it. But I was very disappointed in that, because we felt this was an area that we could really do a job in helping these people.
How many since you've been in this job, how many Republican candidates do you recall getting endorsed? They have FCO endorsements.
Two that I know of. We helped elect a Senator Glisson in this last election. By the way, we were really taking a big chance. The Democrat was strongly supported by the governor, but we felt that Glisson was a better man for us, and we supported him, and he was elected. Yeah, there again was the effect of a rural effort.
He is from where?
Eustis. And he's been a very good senator and very friendly to organized labor. And we did endorse, and well, probably more than two have gotten endorsements, but I was thinking in terms of two, we've gotten elected, we elected, or helped elect a Republican in Broward County who was, this was very difficult to do because Broward tends to be Republican. This was a very liberal Republican. We helped him get elected. We have endorsed. We probably don't find enough people who are liberal or take a good view of labor's point of view, even in the Democratic Party, much less in the Republican Party. That's a big problem.
Who is a Republican in Broward?
Name was, let me think now, it's way going way back.
Oh, that's all right.
I can't think of it right now. But Senator Glisson was the one that stands out in my mind, you know, statewide. We probably will. It wouldn't surprise me, let me put it this way, it wouldn't surprise me to see us endorse a Republican in some of these races that we have coming up this year. Again, we don't know who the candidates are going to be. We find ourselves with this cabinet. If you've been following Florida news at all, you find that we've already lost the Commissioner of Education through indictments. The comptroller is under investigation right now. There's a shadow hanging over the state treasurer's office. So we just don't know what's going to happen in the next few months.